Arm end of the mighty double spiral that was the Milky Way. Its fall was colossal, too, and a long one, for it had a long way to go. It had been falling for centuries before one man became really aware of that fall. That man was Harry Seldon, the man who represented the one spark of creative effort left among the gathering decay. He developed and brought to its highest pitch the science of psychohistory. Psychohistory dealt not with man, but with man masses. It was the science of mobs, mobs in their billions. It could forecast reactions to stimuli with something of the accuracy that a lesser science could bring to the forecast of a rebound of a billiard ball. The reaction of one man could be forecast by no known mathematics. The reaction of a billion is something else again. Harry Seldon plotted the social and economic trends of the time, sighted along the curves, and foresaw the continuing and accelerating fall of civilization and the gap of 30,000 years that must elapse before a struggling new empire could emerge from the ruins. It was too late to stop that fall, but not too late to close the gap of barbarism. Seldon established two foundations at opposite ends of the galaxy, and their location was so designed that in one short millennium, events would knit and mesh so as to force out of them a stronger, more permanent, more quickly appearing second empire. Foundation, Nome Press, 1951, has told the story of one of those foundations during the first two centuries of life. It began as a settlement of physical scientists on Terminus, a planet at the extreme end of one of the spiral arms of the galaxy. Separated from the turmoil of the Empire, they worked as compilers of a universal compendium of knowledge, the Encyclopedia Galactica, unaware of the deeper role planned for them by the already dead Seldon. As the Empire rotted, the outer regions fell into the hands of independent kings. The Foundation was threatened by them. However, by playing one petty ruler against another, under the leadership of their first mayor, Salvor Hardin, they maintained a precarious independence. As sole possessors of atomic power among worlds, which were losing their sciences and falling back on coal and oil, they even established an ascendancy. The Foundation became the religious center of the neighboring kingdoms. Slowly, the Foundation developed a trading economy as the Encyclopedia receded into the background. Their traders, dealing in atomic gadgets which not even the Empire in its heyday could have duplicated for compactness, penetrated hundreds of light years through the periphery. Under Hobler-Mallow, the first of the Foundation's merchant princes, they developed the techniques of economic warfare to the point of defeating the Republic of Corel, even though that world was receiving support from one of the outer provinces of what was left of the Empire. At the end of 200 years, the Foundation was the most powerful state in the galaxy, except for the remains of the Empire, which, concentrated in the central third of the Milky Way, still controlled three-quarters of the population and wealth of the universe. It seemed inevitable that the next danger the Foundation would have to face was the final lash of the dying Empire. The way must be cleared for the battle of Foundation and Empire. Part 1. The General. Chapter 1. Search for Magicians. Bel Rios. In his relatively short career, Rios earned the title of the Last of the Imperials, and earned it well. A study of his campaigns reveals him to be the equal of Purifoy in strategic ability, and his superior, perhaps, in his ability to handle men. That he was born in the days of the decline of the Empire made it all but impossible for him to equal Purifoy's record as a conqueror. Yet he had his chance when, the first of the Empire's generals to do so, he faced the Foundation squarely. Encyclopedia Galactica. Footnote. All quotations from the Encyclopedia Galactica here reproduced are taken from the 116th edition, published in 1020 FE, by the Encyclopedia Galactica Publishing Company, Terminus, with permission of the publishers. Bel Rios traveled without escort, which is not what court etiquette prescribes for the head of a fleet stationed in a yet sullen stellar system on the marches of the Galactic Empire. But Bel Rios was young and energetic, energetic enough to be sent as near the end of the universe as possible by an unemotional and calculating court, and curious besides. Strange and improbable tales, fancifully repeated by hundreds and murkily known to thousands, intrigued the last faculty. The possibility of a military venture engaged the other two. The combination was overpowering. He was out of the dowdy ground car he had appropriated and at the door of the fading mansion that was his destination. He waited. The photonic eye that spanned the doorway was alive, but when the door opened, it was by hand. Belrios smiled at the old man. "I am Rios. I recognize you." The old man remained stiffly and unsurprised in his place. "Your business?" Rios withdrew a step in a gesture of submission. "One of peace. If you are Dukembar, I ask the favor of conversation." Dukembar stepped aside, and in the interior of the house, the walls glowed into life. The general entered into daylight. He touched the wall of the study, then stared at his fingertips. "You have this on Siwena?" Barr smiled thinly. "Not elsewhere, I believe. I keep this in repair myself as well as I can. I must apologize for your wait at the door. The automatic device registers the presence of a visitor, but will no longer open the door. Your repairs fall short?" The general's voice was faintly mocking. "Parts are no longer available. If you will sit, sir. You drink tea? On Siwena? My good sir, it is socially impossible not to drink it here." The old patrician retreated noiselessly with a slow bow that was part of the ceremonious legacy left by a ci-devant aristocracy of the last century's better days. Rios looked after his host's departing figure, and his studied urbanity grew a bit uncertain at the edges. His education had been purely military, his experience likewise. He had, as the cliché has it, faced death many times, but always death of a very familiar and tangible nature. Consequently, there is no inconsistency in the fact that the idolized lion of the 20th Fleet felt chilled in the suddenly musty atmosphere of an ancient room. The general recognized the small black Ivroid boxes that lined the shelves to be books. Their titles were unfamiliar. He guessed that the large structure at one end of the room was the receiver that transmuted the books into sight and sound on demand. He had never seen one in operation, but he had heard of them. Once he had been told that long before, during the golden ages when the empire had been coextensive with the entire galaxy, 9 houses out of every 10 had such receivers and such rows of books. But there were borders to watch now. Books were for old men, and half the stories told about the old days were mythical anyway. More than half. The tea arrived, and Rios seated himself. Dukembar lifted his cup. "To your honor?" "Thank you. To yours." Dukembar said deliberately, "You are said to be young. 35? "Near enough, 34. "In that case," said Barr with soft emphasis, "I could not begin better than by informing you regretfully that I am not in the possession of love charms, potions, or philtres, nor am I in the least capable of influencing the favors of any young lady as may appeal to you. I have no need of artificial aids in that respect, sir." The complacency undeniably present in the general's voice was stirred with amusement. "Do you receive many requests for such commodities?" "Enough. Unfortunately, an uninformed public tends to confuse scholarship with magicianry, and love life seems to be that factor which requires the largest quantity of magical tinkering. And so would seem most natural. But I differ. I connect scholarship with nothing but the means of answering difficult questions." The Siwenian considered somberly, "You may be as wrong as they." "That may be or not." The young general set down his cup in its flaring sheath, and it refilled. He dropped the offered flavor capsule into it with a small splash. "Tell me then, patrician, who are the magicians, the real ones?" Barr seemed startled at a title long unused. He said, There are no magicians, but people speak of them. Siwenna crawls with the tales of them. There are cults being built around them. There is some strange connection between it and those groups among your countrymen who dream and drivel of ancient days and what they call liberty and autonomy. Eventually, the matter might become a danger to the state. The old man shook his head. Why ask me? Do you smell rebellion with myself at the head? Rio shrugged. Never. Never. Oh, it is not a thought completely ridiculous. Your father was an exile in his day. You yourself a patriot and a chauvinist in yours. It is indelicate in me as a guest to mention it, but my business here requires it. And yet, a conspiracy now? I doubt it. Siwenia has had the spirit beat out of it these three generations. The old man replied with difficulty. I shall be as indelicate a host as you a guest. I shall remind you that once a viceroy thought as you did of the spiritless Siwenians. By the orders of that viceroy, my father became a fugitive pauper, my brothers martyrs, and my sister a suicide. Yet that viceroy died a death sufficiently horrible at the hands of these same slavish Siwenians. Ah, yes. And there you touch nearly on something I could wish to say. For 3 years, the mysterious death of that viceroy has been no mystery to me. There was a young soldier of his personal guard whose actions were of interest. You were that soldier. But there is no need of details, I think. Barr was quiet. None. What do you propose? That you answer my questions. Not under threats. I am old, but not yet so old that life means particularly overmuch. My good sir, these are hard times, said Rios with meaning. And you have children and friends. You have a country for which you have mouthed phrases of love and folly in the past. Come, if I should decide to use force, my aim would not be so poor as to strike you. Barr said coldly, What do you want? Rios held the empty cup as he spoke. Patrician, listen to me. These are days when the most successful soldiers are those whose function is to lead the dress parades that wind through the imperial palace grounds on feast days, and to escort the sparkling pleasure ships that carry his imperial splendor to the summer planets. I am a failure. I am a failure at 34, and I shall stay a failure. Because, you see, I like to fight. That's why they sent me here. I'm too troublesome at court. I don't fit in with the etiquette. I offend the dandies and the Lord Admirals. But I'm too good a leader of ships and men to be disposed of shortly by being marooned in space. So Siwenna is the substitute. It's a frontier world, a rebellious and a barren province. It is far away, far enough to satisfy all. And so I molder. There are no rebellions to stamp down, and the border viceroys do not revolt lately. At least not since His Imperial Majesty's late father of glorious memory made an example of Mountel of Parame. A strong emperor, muttered Barr. Yes, and we need more of them. He is my master. Remember that. These are his interests I guard. Barr shrugged unconcernedly. How does all this relate to the subject? I'll show you in two words. The magicians I've mentioned come from beyond, out there beyond the frontier guards. Where the stars are scattered thinly, where the stars are scattered thinly, quoted Barr, and the cold of space seeps in. Is that poetry? Rios frowned. Verse seemed frivolous at the moment. In any case, they're from the periphery, from the only quarter where I am free to fight for the glory of the Emperor, and thus serve His Imperial Majesty's interests and satisfy your own love of a good fight. Exactly. But I must know what I fight, and there you can help. How do you know? Rios nibbled casually at a cakelet. Because for 3 years I have traced every rumor, every myth, every breath concerning the magicians, and of all the library of information I have gathered, only two isolated facets are unanimously agreed upon, and are hence certainly true. The first is that the magicians come from the edge of the galaxy opposite Siwenna. The second is that your father once met a magician, alive and actual, and spoke with him. The aged Sewenian stared unblinkingly, and Rios continued. You had better tell me what you know. Barr said thoughtfully, It would be interesting to tell you certain things. It would be a psycho-historic experiment of my own. What kind of experiment? Psycho-historic. The old man had an unpleasant edge to his smile. Then crisply, You'd better have more tea. I'm going to make a bit of a speech. He leaned far back into the soft cushions of his chair. The wall lights had softened into a pink ivory glow, which mellowed even the soldier's hard profile. Duquembar began, My own knowledge is the result of two accidents, the accidents of being born the son of my father and of being born the native of my country. It begins over 40 years ago, shortly after the Great Massacre, when my father was a fugitive in the forests of the South, while I was a gunner in the Viceroy's personal fleet. This same Viceroy, by the way, who had ordered the massacre, and who died such a cruel death thereafter. Barr smiled grimly and continued. My father was a patrician of the Empire and a senator of Siena. His name was Onum Barr. Rios interrupted impatiently. I know the circumstances of his exile very well. You needn't elaborate upon it. The Siwenian ignored him and proceeded without deflection. During his exile, a wanderer came upon him, a merchant from the edge of the galaxy, a young man who spoke a strange accent, knew nothing of recent imperial history, and who was protected by an individual force shield. An individual force shield? Rios glared. You speak extravagance. What generator could be powerful enough to condense a shield to the size of a single man? By the great galaxy, did he carry 5,000 myriad tons of atomic power source about with him on a little wheeled go-kart? Barr said quietly, This is the magician of whom you hear whispers, stories, and myths. The name magician is not lightly earned. He carried no generator large enough to be seen, but not the heaviest weapon you can carry in your hand would have as much as creased the shield he bore. Is this all the story there is? Are the magicians born of maunderings of an old man, broken by suffering and exile? The story of the magicians antedated even my father, sir, and the proof is more concrete. After leaving my father, this merchant that men call a magician visited a tech man at the city to which my father had guided him, and there he left a shield generator of the type he wore. That generator was retrieved by my father after his return from exile upon the execution of the bloody viceroy. It took a long time to find. The generator hangs on the wall behind you, sir. It does not work. It never worked but for the first 2 days. But if you'll look at it, you will see that no one in the Empire ever designed it. Belrios reached for the belt of linked metal that clung to the curved wall. It came away with a little sucking noise as the tiny adhesion field broke at the touch of his hand. The ellipsoid at the apex of the belt held his attention. It was the size of a walnut. This, he said, was the generator, nodded Barr. But it was the generator. The secret of its workings are beyond discovery now. Sub-electronic investigations have shown it to be fused into a single lump of metal, and not all the most careful study of the diffraction patterns have sufficed to distinguish the discrete parts that had existed before fusion. Then your proof still lingers on the frothy border of words backed by no concrete evidence. Barr shrugged. You have demanded my knowledge of me and threatened its extortion by force. If you choose to meet it with skepticism, what is that to me? Do you want me to stop? Go on, said the general harshly. I continued my father's researches after he died, and then the second accident I mentioned came to help me, for Siwenna was well known to Harry Seldon. And who is Harry Seldon? Harry Seldon was a scientist of the reign of the Emperor Dalyuban IV. He was a psychohistorian, the last and greatest of them all. He once visited Siwenna, when Siwenna was a great commercial center, rich in the arts and sciences. Muttered Rio sourly. Where is the stagnant planet that does not claim to have been a land of overflowing wealth in older days? The days I speak of are the days of 2 centuries ago, when the Emperor yet ruled to the uttermost star, when Siwenna was a world of the interior and not a semi-barbarian border province. In those days, Harry Seldon foresaw the decline of imperial power and the eventual barbarization of the entire galaxy. Rios laughed suddenly. He foresaw that? Then he foresaw wrong, my good scientist. I suppose you call yourself that. Why, the Empire is more powerful now than it has been in a millennium. Your old eyes are blinded by the cold bleakness of the border. Come to the inner world someday. Come to the warmth and the wealth of the center. The old man shook his head somberly. Circulation ceases first at the outer edges. It will take a while yet for the decay to reach the heart. That is, the apparent, obvious to all decay, as distinct from the inner decay that is an old story of some 15 centuries. And so this Harry Seldon foresaw a galaxy of uniform barbarism, said Rios good-humoredly. And what then, huh? So he established 2 foundations at the extreme opposing ends of the galaxy. Foundations of the best and the youngest and the strongest. They are to breed, grow, and develop. The worlds on which they were placed were chosen carefully, as were the times and the surroundings. All was arranged in such a way that the future, as foreseen by the unalterable mathematics of psychohistory, would involve their early isolation from the main body of imperial civilization and their gradual growth into the germs of the Second Galactic Empire, cutting an inevitable barbarian interregnum from 30,000 years to scarcely a single thousand. And where did you find out all this? You seem to know it in detail. I don't, and never did, said the patrician with composure. It is the painful result of the piecing together of certain evidence discovered by my father, and a little more found by myself. The basis is flimsy, and the superstructure has been romanticized into existence to fill the huge gaps. But I am convinced that it is essentially true. You are easily convinced. Am I? It has taken 40 years of research. 40 years. I could settle the question in 40 days. In fact, I believe I ought to. It would be different. And how would you do that? In the obvious way, I would become an explorer. I could find this foundation you speak of and observe with my eyes. You say there are 2? The records speak of 2. Supporting evidence has been found only for 1, which is understandable, for the other is at the extreme end of the long axis of the galaxy. Well, we'll visit the near one. The general was on his feet, adjusting his belt. You know where to go? Asked Barr. In a way. In the records of the last viceroy but 1, he whom you murdered so effectively, there are suspicious tales of outer barbarians. In fact, one of his daughters was given in marriage to a barbarian prince. I'll find my way. He held out a hand. I thank you for your hospitality. Dukembar touched the hand with his fingers and bowed formally. Your visit was a great honor. As for the information you gave me, continued Belrios, I'll know how to thank you for that when I return. Dukembar followed his guest submissively to the outer door and said quietly to the disappearing ground car, and if you return. Chapter 2, The Magicians. Foundation. With 40 years of expansion behind them, the Foundation faced the menace of Rios. The epic days of Hardin and Mallow had gone, and with them a certain hard daring and resolution. Encyclopedia Galactica. There were 4 men in the room, and the room was set apart where none could approach. The 4 men looked at each other quickly, then lengthily at the table that separated them. There were 4 bottles on the table, and as many glasses, but no one had touched them. And then the man nearest the door stretched out an arm and drummed a slow, padding rhythm on the table. He said, "Are you going to sit and wonder forever?" Does it matter who speaks first? Speak you first, then, said the big man directly opposite. You're the one who should be the most worried. Senate Farrell chuckled with noiseless non-humor. Because you think I'm the richest. Well, or is it that you expect me to continue as I have started? I don't suppose you forget that it was my own trade fleet that captured this scout ship of theirs. You had the largest fleet, said a third, and the best pilots, which is another way of saying you are the richest. It was a fearful risk, and would have been greater for one of us. Senate Farrell chuckled again. There is a certain facility in risk-taking that I inherit from my father. After all, the essential point in running a risk is that the returns justify it. As to which, witness the fact that the enemy ship was isolated and captured without loss to ourselves or warning to the others. That Farrell was a distant collateral relative of the late great Hober Mallow was recognized openly throughout the Foundation. That he was Mallow's illegitimate son was accepted quietly to just as wide an extent. The fourth man blinked his little eyes stealthily. Words crept out from between thin lips. It is nothing to sleep over in fat triumph, this grasping of little ships. Most likely, it will but anger that young man further. You think he needs motives? Questioned Farrell scornfully. I do. And this might, or will, save him the vexation of having to manufacture one. The fourth man spoke slowly. Hober Mallow worked otherwise, and Salvor Hardin. They let others take the uncertain paths of force, while they maneuvered surely and quietly. Farrell shrugged. The ship has proved its value. Motives are cheap, and we have sold this one at a profit. There was the satisfaction of the born trader in that. He continued, The young man is of the old empire. We knew that, said the second man, the big one, with rumbling discontent. We suspected that, corrected Farrell softly. If a man comes with ships and wealth, with overtures of friendliness, and with offers of trade, it is only sensible to refrain from antagonizing him until we are certain that the profitable mask is not a face after all. But now... There was a faint whining edge to the third man's voice as he spoke. We might have been even more careful. We might have found out first. We might have found out before allowing him to leave. It would have been the truest wisdom. That has been discussed and disposed of, said Farrell. He waved the subject aside with a flatly final gesture. The government is soft, complained the third man. The mayor is an idiot. The fourth man looked at the other three in turn and removed the stub of a cigar from his mouth. He dropped it casually into the slot at his right, where it disappeared with a silent flash of disruption. He said sarcastically, I trust the gentleman who spoke last is speaking through habit only. We can afford to remember here that we are the government. There was a murmur of agreement. The fourth man's little eyes were on the table. Then let us leave government policy alone. This young man, this stranger, might have been a possible customer. There have been cases. All three of you tried to butter him into an advance contract. We have an agreement, a gentleman's agreement against it. But you tried. So did you, growled the second man. I know it, said the fourth calmly. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Then let's forget what we should have done earlier, interrupted Farrell impatiently, and continue with what we should do now. In any case, what if we had imprisoned him or killed him? What then? We are not certain of his intentions even yet, and at the worst, we could not destroy an empire by snipping short one man's life. There might be navies upon navies waiting just the other side of his non-return. Exactly, approved the fourth man. Now what did you get out of your captured ship? I'm too old for all this talking. It can be told in few enough words, said Farrell grimly. He's an imperial general, or whatever rank corresponds to that over there. He's a young man who has proved his military brilliance, so I am told, and who is the idol of his men. Quite a romantic career. The stories they tell of him are no doubt half lies, but even so it makes him out to be a type of Wonder Man. Who are the they? Demanded the second man. The crew of the captured ship. Look, I have all their statements recorded on microfilm, which I have in a secure place. Later on, if you wish, you can see them. You can talk to the men yourselves if you think it necessary. I've told you the essentials. How did you get it out of them? How do you know they're telling the truth? Farrell frowned. I wasn't gentle, good sir. I knocked them about, drugged them crazy, and used the probe unmercifully. They talked. You can believe them. In the old days, said the third man with sudden irrelevance, they would have used pure psychology. Painless, you know, but very sure. No chance of deceit. Well, there is a good deal they had in the old days, said Farrell dryly. These are the new days. But, said the fourth man, what did he want here, this general, this romantic Wonder Man? There was a dogged, weary persistence about him. Farrell glanced at him sharply. You think he confides the details of state policy to his crew? They didn't know. There was nothing to get out of them in that respect, and I tried, Galaxy knows. Which leaves us to draw our own conclusions, obviously. Farrell's fingers were tapping quietly again. The young man is a military leader of the Empire, yet he played the pretense of being a minor princeling of some scattered stars in an odd corner of the periphery. That alone would assure us that his real motives are such as it would not benefit him to have us know. Combine the nature of his profession with the fact that the Empire has already subsidized one attack upon us in my father's time, and the possibilities become ominous. That first attack failed. I doubt that the Empire owes us love for that. There is nothing in your findings, questioned the fourth man guardedly, which makes for certainty. You are withholding nothing? Farrell answered levelly, I can't withhold anything. From here on, there can be no question of business rivalry. Unity is forced upon us. Patriotism? There was a sneer in the third man's thin voice. Patriotism be damned, said Farrell quietly. Do you think I give two puffs of atomic emanation for the future Second Empire? Do you think I'd risk a single trade mission to soothe its path? But do you suppose imperial conquest will help my business or yours? If the Empire wins, there will be a sufficient number of yearning carrion crows to crave the rewards of battle. And we're the rewards, added the fourth man dryly. The second man broke his silence suddenly and shifted his bulk angrily so that the chair creaked under him. But why talk of that? The Empire can't win, can it? There is Selden's assurance that we will form the Second Empire in the end. This is only another crisis. There have been three before this. Only another crisis, yes, Farrell brooded. But in the case of the first two, we had Salvor Hardin to guide us. In the third, there was Hober Mallow. Whom have we now? He looked at the others somberly and continued, Selden's rules of psychohistory, on which it is so comforting to rely, probably have as one of the contributing variables a certain normal initiative on the part of the people of the Foundation themselves. Selden's laws help those who help themselves. The times make the man, said the third man. There's another proverb for you. You can't count on that, not with absolute assurance, grunted Farrell. Now, the way it seems to me is this. If this is the fourth crisis, then Selden has foreseen it. If he has, then it can be beaten, and there should be a way of doing it. Now, the Empire is stronger than we. It always has been. But this is the first time we are in danger of its direct attack, so that strength becomes terribly menacing. Then if it can be beaten, it must be once again, as in all past crises, by a method other than pure force. We must find the weak side of its enemy and attack it there. And what is that weak side? Asked the fourth man. Do you intend advancing a theory? No. That is the point I'm leading up to. Our great leaders of the past always saw the weak points of their enemies and aimed at that. But now... There was a helplessness in his voice, and for a moment none volunteered a comment. Then the fourth man said, We need spies. Farrell turned to him eagerly. Right. I don't know when the Empire will attack. There may be time. Obermallow himself entered the Imperial dominions, suggested the second man. But Farrell shook his head. Nothing so direct. None of us are precisely youthful, and all of us are rusty with red tape and administrative detail. We need young men that are in the field now. The independent traders? Asked the fourth man. And Farrell nodded his head and whispered, if there is yet time. Chapter 3. The Dead Hand. Belrios interrupted his annoyed stridings to look up hopefully when his aide entered. Any word of the starlet? None. The scouting party has quartered space, but the instruments have detected nothing. Commander Hume has reported that the fleet is ready for an immediate attack in retaliation. The general shook his head. No, not for a patrol ship. Not yet. Tell him to double... Wait. I'll write out the message. Have it coded and transmitted by tight beam. He wrote as he talked and thrust the paper at the waiting officer. Has the Sewenian arrived yet? Not yet. Well, see to it that he is brought in here as soon as he does arrive. The aide saluted crisply and left. Rios resumed his caged stride. When the door opened a second time, it was Dukem Barr that stood on the threshold. Slowly, in the footsteps of the ushering aide, he stepped into the garish room, whose ceiling was an ornamented stereoscopic model of the galaxy, and in the center of which Belrios stood in field uniform. Patrician, good day. The general pushed forward a chair with his foot and gestured the aide away with a, that door is to stay closed till I open it. He stood before the Sewenian, legs apart, hand grasping wrist behind his back, balancing himself slowly, thoughtfully, on the balls of his feet. Then harshly, Patrician, are you a loyal subject of the Emperor? Barr, who had maintained an indifferent silence till then, wrinkled a noncommittal brow. I have no cause to love imperial rule, which is a long way from saying that you would be a traitor. True, but the mere act of not being a traitor is also a long way from agreeing to be an active helper. Ordinarily also true, but to refuse your help at this point, said Rios deliberately, will be considered treason and treated as such. Barr's eyebrows drew together. Save your verbal cudgels for your subordinates. A simple statement of your needs and wants will suffice me here. Rios sat down and crossed his legs. Barr, we had an earlier discussion half a year ago. About your magicians? Yes. You remember what I said I would do? Barr nodded. His arms rested limply in his lap. You were going to visit them in their haunts, and you've been away these 4 months. Did you find them? Find them. That I did, cried Rios. His lips were stiff as he spoke. It seemed to require effort to refrain from grinding molars. Patrician, they are not magicians. They are devils. It is as far from belief as the outer nebulae from here. Conceive it. It is a world the size of a handkerchief, of a fingernail, with resources so petty, powers so minute, a population so microscopic as would never suffice the most backward worlds of the dusty prefects of the dark stars. Yet with that, a people so proud and ambitious as to dream quietly and methodically of galactic rule. Why, they are so sure of themselves that they do not even hurry. They move slowly, phlegmatically. They speak of necessary centuries. They swallow worlds at leisure, creep through systems with dawdling complacence. And they succeed. There is no one to stop them. They have built up a filthy trading community that curls its tentacles about the systems further than their toy ships dare reach. For parsecs, their traders, which is what their agents call themselves, penetrate. Dukem Barr interrupted the angry flow. How much of this information is definite, and how much is simply fury? The soldier caught his breath and grew calmer. My fury does not blind me. I tell you I was in worlds nearer to Sewenna than to the Foundation, where the Empire was a myth of the distance and where traitors were living truths. We ourselves were mistaken for traitors. The Foundation itself told you they aimed at galactic dominion? Told me? Rios was violent again. It was not a matter of telling me. The officials said nothing. They spoke business exclusively. But I spoke to ordinary men. I absorbed the ideas of the common folk, their manifest destiny, their calm acceptance of a great future. It is a thing that can't be hidden, a universal optimism they don't even try to hide. The Sewenian openly displayed a certain quiet satisfaction. You will notice that so far it would seem to bear out quite accurately my reconstruction of events from the paltry data on the subject that I have gathered. It is no doubt, replied Rios with vexed sarcasm, a tribute to your analytical powers. It is also a hearty and bumptious commentary on the growing danger to the domains of His Imperial Majesty. Barr shrugged his unconcern, and Rios leaned forward suddenly to seize the old man's shoulders and stare with curious gentleness into his eyes. He said, Now, Patrician, none of that. I have no desire to be barbaric. For my part, the legacy of Sewenian hostility to the Imperium is an odious burden, and one which I would do everything in my power to wipe out. But my province is the military, and interference in civil affairs is impossible. It would bring about my recall and ruin my usefulness at once. You see that? I know you see that. Between yourself and myself, then, let the atrocity of 40 years ago be repaid by your vengeance upon its author, and so forgotten. I need your help. I frankly admit it. There was a world of urgency in the young man's voice, but Ducambar's head shook gently and deliberately in a negative gesture. Rios said pleadingly, You don't understand, Patrician, and I doubt my ability to make you. I can't argue on your ground. You're the scholar, not I. But this I can tell you. Whatever you think of the Empire, you will admit its great services. Its armed forces have committed isolated crimes, but in the main they have been a force for peace and civilization. It was the Imperial Navy that created the Pax Imperium that ruled over all the galaxy for 2,000 years. Contrast the 12 millennia of peace under the sun and spaceship of the Empire with the 2 millennia of interstellar anarchy that preceded it. Consider the wars and devastations of those old days and tell me if, with all its faults, the Empire is not worth preserving. Consider, he drove on forcefully, to what the outer fringe of the galaxy is reduced in these days of their breakaway and independence, and ask yourself if, for the sake of a petty revenge, you would reduce Sewenna from its position as a province under the protection of a mighty navy to a barbarian world in a barbarian galaxy, all immersed in its fragmentary independence and its common degradation and misery. Is it so bad? So soon? Murmured the Sewenian. No, admitted Rios. We would be safe ourselves, no doubt, were our lifetimes quadrupled. But it is for the Empire I fight. That and a military tradition which is something for myself alone, and which I cannot transfer to you. It is a military tradition built on the Imperial institution which I serve. You're getting mystical. And I always find it difficult to penetrate another person's mysticism. No matter. You understand the danger of this foundation. It was I who pointed out what you called the danger before ever you headed outward from Sewenna. Then you realized that it must be stopped in embryo, or perhaps not at all. You have known of this foundation before anyone had heard of it. You know more about it than anyone else in the Empire. You probably know how it might be best attacked. And you can probably forewarn me of its countermeasures. Come, let us be friends. Ducambar rose. He said flatly, Such help as I could give you means nothing, so I will make you free of it in the face of your strenuous demand. I will be the judge of its meaning. No, I am serious. Not all the might of the Empire could avail to crush this pygmy world. Why not? Belrios's eyes glistened fiercely. No, stay where you are. I'll tell you when you may leave. Why not? If you think I underestimate this enemy I have discovered, you are wrong. Patrician, he spoke reluctantly, I lost a ship on my return. I have no proof that it fell into the hands of the Foundation, but it has not been located since, and were it merely an accident, its dead hulk should certainly have been found along the route we took. It is not an important loss, less than the tenth part of a flea bite, but it may mean that the Foundation has already opened hostilities. Such eagerness and such disregard for consequences might mean secret forces of which I know nothing. Can you help me, then, by answering a specific question? What is their military power? I haven't any notion. Then explain yourself on your own terms. Why do you say the Empire cannot defeat this small enemy? The Sewenian seated himself once more and looked away from Rios's fixed glare. He spoke heavily. Because I have faith in the principles of psychohistory. It is a strange science. It reached mathematical maturity with one man, Harry Seldon, and died with him, for no man since has been capable of manipulating its intricacies. But in that short period, it proved itself the most powerful instrument ever invented for the study of humanity. Without pretending to predict the actions of individual humans, it formulated definite laws capable of mathematical analysis and extrapolation to govern and predict the mass action of human groups. So, it was that psychohistory which Seldon and the group he worked with applied in full force to the establishment of the Foundation. The place, time, and conditions all conspire mathematically and so inevitably to the development of universal empire. Rios's voice trembled with indignation. You mean that this art of his predicts that I would attack the Foundation and lose such and such a battle for such and such a reason? Are you trying to say that I am a silly robot following a predetermined course into destruction? No, replied the old patrician sharply. I have already said that the science has nothing to do with individual actions. It is the vaster background that has been foreseen. Then we stand clasped tightly in the forcing hand of the goddess of historical necessity? Of psycho-historical necessity, prompted Barr softly. And if I exercise my prerogative of free will? If I choose to attack next year, or not to attack at all? How pliable is the goddess? How resourceful? Barr shrugged. Attack now or never, with a single ship or all the force in the Empire. By military force or economic pressure, by candid declaration of war, or by treacherous ambush. Do whatever you wish in your fullest exercise of free will. You will still lose. Because of Harry Seldon's dead hand, because of the dead hand of the mathematics of human behavior, that can neither be stopped, swerved, nor delayed. The two faced each other in deadlock until the general stepped back. He said simply, I'll take that challenge. It's a dead hand against a living will. Chapter 4. The Emperor. Cleon II, commonly called the Great, the last strong emperor of the First Empire, he is important for the political and artistic renaissance that took place during his long reign. He is best known to romance, however, for his connection with Bel Rios, and to the common man, he is simply Rios's emperor. It is important not to allow events of the last year of his reign to overshadow 40 years of Encyclopedia Galactica. Cleon II was Lord of the Universe. Cleon II also suffered from a painful and undiagnosed ailment. By the queer twists of human affairs, the two statements are not mutually exclusive, nor even particularly incongruous. There have been a wearisomely large number of precedents in history. But Cleon II cared nothing for such precedents. To meditate upon a long list of similar cases would not ameliorate personal suffering an electron's worth. It soothed him as little to think that where his great-grandfather had been the pirate ruler of a dust-speck planet, he himself slept in the pleasure palace of Amenetic the Great, as heir in a line of galactic rulers stretching backward into a tenuous past. It was at present no source of comfort to him that the efforts of his father had cleansed the realm of its leprous patches of rebellion and restored it to the peace and unity it had enjoyed under Stanel VI. That as a consequence, in the 25 years of his reign, not one cloud of revolt had misted his burnished glory. The Emperor of the Galaxy, and the Lord of All, whimpered as he lolled his head backward into the invigorating plane of force about his pillows. It yielded in a softness that did not touch, and at the pleasant tingle, Cleon relaxed a bit. He sat up with difficulty and stared morosely at the distant walls of the Grand Chamber. It was a bad room to be alone in. It was too big. All the rooms were too big. But better to be alone during these crippling bouts than to endure the prickling of the courtiers, their lavish sympathy, their soft, condescending dullness. Better to be alone than to watch those insipid masks, behind which spun the tortuous speculations on the chances of death and the fortunes of the succession. His thoughts hurried him. There were his three sons, three straight-backed youths full of promise and virtue. Where did they disappear on these bad days? Waiting, no doubt, each watching the other, and all watching him. He stirred uneasily. And now Broderick craved audience. The low-born, faithful Broderick. Faithful because he was hated with the unanimous and cordial hatred that was the only point of agreement between the dozen cliques that divided his court. Broderick, the faithful favorite, who had to be faithful, since unless he owned the fastest speed ship in the galaxy and took it to the day of the Emperor's death, it would be the Atom Chamber the day after. Cleon II touched the smooth knob on the arm of his great divan, and the huge door at the end of the room dissolved to transparency. Broderick advanced along the crimson carpet and knelt to kiss the Emperor's limp hand. "Your health, sire?" asked the Privy Secretary in a low tone of becoming anxiety. "I live," snapped the Emperor with exasperation. "If you can call it life, where every scoundrel who can read a book of medicine uses me as a blank and receptive field for his feeble experiments. If there is a conceivable remedy, chemical, physical, or atomic, which has not yet been tried, why then some learned babbler from the far corners of the realm will arrive tomorrow to try it. And still another newly discovered book, or forgery more like, will be used as authority. By my father's memory," he rumbled savagely, "it seems there is not a biped extant who can study a disease before his eyes with those same eyes. There is not one who can count a pulse beat without a book of the ancients before him. I'm sick, and they call it unknown. The fools! If in the course of millennia human bodies learn new methods of falling askew, it remains uncovered by the studies of the ancients and uncurable forevermore. The ancient should be alive now, or I then." The Emperor ran down to a low-breathed curse, while Broderick waited dutifully. Cleon II said peevishly, "How many are waiting outside?" He jerked his hand in the direction of the door. Broderick said patiently, "The great hall holds the usual number." "Well, let them wait. State matters occupy me. Have the captain of the guard announce it. Oh, wait. Forget the state matters. Just have it announced I hold no audience, and let the captain of the guard look doleful. The jackals among them may betray themselves." The Emperor sneered nastily. "There is a rumor, sire," said Broderick smoothly, "that it is your heart that troubles you." The Emperor's smile was little removed from the previous sneer. "It will hurt others more than myself if any act prematurely on that rumor. But what is it you want? Let's have this over." Broderick rose from his kneeling posture at a gesture of permission and said, "It concerns General Bel Rios, the military governor of Siwenna." "Rios?" Cleon II frowned heavily. "I don't place him. Wait. Is he the one who sent that quixotic message some months back?" "Yes, I remember. He panted for permission to enter a career of conquest for the glory of the Empire and Emperor." "Exactly, sire." The Emperor laughed shortly. "Did you think I had such generals left me, Broderick? He seems to be a curious atavism. What was the answer? I believe you took care of it." "I did, sire. He was instructed to forward additional information and to take no steps involving naval action without further orders from the Imperium." "Safe enough. Who is this Rios? Was he ever at court?" Broderick nodded, and his mouth twisted ever so little. He began his career as a cadet in the Guards 10 years back. He had part in that affair off the Lemel Cluster. The Lemel Cluster. You know, my memory isn't quite... Was that the time a young soldier saved 2 ships of the line from a head-on collision by... something or other? He waved a hand impatiently. I don't remember the details. It was something heroic. Rios was that soldier. He received a promotion for it, Broderick said dryly, and an appointment to field duty as captain of a ship. And now military governor of a border system, and still young. Capable man, Broderick. Unsafe, sire. He lives in the past. He is a dreamer of ancient times, or rather, of the myths of what ancient times used to be. Such men are harmless in themselves, but their queer lack of realism makes them fools for others. He added, his men, I understand, are completely under his control. He is one of your popular generals. Is he? The Emperor mused. Well, come, Broderick, I would not wish to be served entirely by incompetence. They certainly set no enviable standard for faithfulness themselves. An incompetent traitor is no danger. It is rather the capable men who must be watched. You among them, Broderick? Cleon II laughed and then grimaced with pain. Well, then, you may forget the lecture for the while. What new development is there in the matter of this young conqueror? I hope you haven't come merely to reminisce. Another message, sire, has been received from General Rios. Oh, and to what effect? He has spied out the land of these barbarians and advocates an expedition in force. His arguments are long and fairly tedious. It is not worth annoying your Imperial Majesty with it at present, during your indisposition, particularly since it will be discussed at length during the session of the Council of Lords. He glanced sidewise at the Emperor. Cleon II frowned. The Lords? Is it a question for them, Broderick? It will mean further demands for a broader interpretation of the Charter. It always comes to that. It can't be avoided, sire. It might have been better if your august father could have beaten down the last rebellion without granting the charter. But since it is here, we must endure it for the while. You're right, I suppose. Then the Lords it must be. But why all this solemnity, man? It is, after all, a minor point. Success on a remote border with limited troops is scarcely a state affair. Broderick smiled narrowly. He said coolly, it is an affair of a romantic idiot. But even a romantic idiot can be a deadly weapon when an unromantic rebel uses him as a tool. Sire, the man was popular here and is popular there. He is young. If he annexes a vagrant barbarian planet or two, he will become a conqueror. Now, a young conqueror who has proven his ability to rouse the enthusiasm of pilots, miners, tradesmen, and such like rabble is dangerous at any time. Even if he lacked the desire to do to you as your august father did to the usurper Ricker, then one of our loyal lords of the domain may decide to use him as his weapon. Cleon II moved an arm hastily and stiffened with pain. Slowly he relaxed, but his smile was weak, and his voice a whisper. You are a valuable subject, Broderick. You always suspect far more than is necessary, and I have but to take half your suggested precautions to be utterly safe. We'll put it up to the Lords. We shall see what they say and take our measures accordingly. The young man, I suppose, has made no hostile moves yet. He reports none, but already he asks for reinforcements. Reinforcements? The Emperor's eyes narrowed with wonder. What force has he? This book is continued on cassette number 2.
10 ships of the line, sire, with a full complement of auxiliary vessels. 2 of the ships are equipped with motors salvaged from the old Grand Fleet, and 1 has a battery of power artillery from the same source. The other ships are new ones of the last 50 years, but are serviceable nevertheless. 10 ships would seem adequate for any reasonable undertaking. Why, with less than 10 ships, my father won his first victories against the usurper. Who are these barbarians he's fighting? The Privy Secretary raised a pair of supercilious eyebrows. he refers to them as the Foundation. The Foundation? What is it? There is no record of it, sire. I have searched the archives carefully. The area of the galaxy indicated falls within the ancient province.